This is an interview with Dr. Lewis C. Jones being conducted at his house at 11 Pomeroy Place in Cooperstown on May 26, 1975. The interviewer is Ellen Flagger. I hope this is better than the one at Williamsburg.
Was there problems at Williamsburg? I'd forgotten.
Well, I guess it was kind of a poor quality mic.
Uh-huh.
Alrighty, well, why don't we begin by me asking you, how did you become interested in folklore?
I come from a family that lived in the northern part of the state for a long time. The Joneses had gone up into Oswego County after the Revolution, I suppose about 1804, and cleared their land and lived up near Pulaski. And my father was very conscious of that, and so that I was aware of family tradition, stories about my pioneer ancestor went up into Oswego County, left his wife and children in Brookfield, or the town nearest is the town of Brookfield on Route 20. One whole season he planted his fields and then left them to harvest and gone on up with a gun and an axe and a horse, I guess, and cleared some land up in Oswego County. And in November, the mother came with the family of five or six small kids in an ox cart. And there's a piece of furniture out in the hall that she had with her. And they hit one of those early November snowstorms, and a passerby went ahead on the horse and told her husband, and he came and met her. And they got to the farm, and she was expecting that there'd be a nice log house there. And as a matter of fact, he sort of dug a hole in the ground for her and the kids, but he had an awfully good barn. It was a rough winter after that, but there was a house built in the spring. But it was this kind of tradition that I'd grown up with, and a family that stayed there for 100 years. So that I was aware of that in a purely personal sense. And in college at Hamilton, I was a lit major and was very interested in ballads. And in my senior year, Carl Sandburg came, and Carl used to do a program for colleges, or generally, which was in three parts. One part was his own poetry, one part was American folk songs, which he sang with a guitar, and a great many of them he'd collected. American Song Bag had come out a little before that, and was really the first great collection of American folk songs. And third, he talked about Lincoln, which he was working on then. And I remember my roommate, Wheaton Webb, who later got very interested in folklore, too, and I went, and we were both very disappointed because we wanted to hear him read his poetry. Mm-hmm. And we really weren't the least damn bit interested in folk song, which we'd never heard before. The only folk song my father knew was Darby's Ram. and were not particularly interested in Lincoln. But that summer, but the next summer, I was just living in New York at graduate school and picked up a secondhand copy of American Song Bag, and it's over there on the shelf, and is the first book of folklore I ever owned. And what I was interested in was first of all, what happened to English and Scottish ballads after they got to this country. Mm-hmm. And then I got particularly interested in the whole question of what historic fact led to the ballad. Remember, a number of them are about specific kings and queens so that we know something of the biographies. I got sort of interested in that whole problem. Then I got married the next year in 72 and was in Albany. I'd lost my job in New York. Long Island University had gone practically bankrupt, and everybody under a full professor got let off. And I came back to Albany. My wife had not given up her job, and so that I was there, and came and was got a job under the TERA, Temporary Relief Administration.
What year was this?
This would be the winter of 32-3. I got a job without pay administering a branch of that first effort on the part of the Hoover administration to solve some of these problems in education. There were a lot of teachers out of work, and there were a lot of kids that needed education and couldn't afford it. And the president of the college, the state college, now the State University at Albany, hadn't known my father all his years there, and said to me, "I can't hire you as a teacher because your wife is working. But if you want to gamble with me and come on and administer this and do a little teaching, as soon as I have an opening in the English department, I'll see if I can place you in it." So I did gamble, and it was my first experience with administration. Then that next, well, so much for that. Teaching there was a man that I had known a long time. This is Harold W. Thompson. Thompson lived about a block and a half from us. He was, in my father's eyes, a bright young man coming on. In my eyes, he was a very mature man, 15 years older than I was. We had both belonged to the same fraternity at Hamilton, a non-Greek independent society called the Emerson Literary Society. And so he knew about me, and I remember he got one of the first Guggenheim Fellows ever given in 1926. And there was a story about it in the Sunday Times, and my father had said, had called him up and asked if he'd seen it, and he said no, and I took it over to him, and it was, that was the first time I had met him. Now this, you see, would be, well, when I was a senior in high school. And that was my first introduction to him. But when I went to the State College to direct this small independent relief administration college, we got to know each other. And being fraternity brothers, and by this time having some interests in common, we became good friends on a older man, younger man basis. And he was planning at that point a course, I think the first of its kind, on American folklore for undergraduates. And he had this remarkable idea of, because there weren't any textbooks, there weren't any collections, there was nothing in general, of sending young people into their families and their hometowns to collect all kinds of material there. Now, you know, we didn't have tape recorders. So you had to do the best you could with writing it down. And the great weakness of his archive and mine later on was just that very often a student couldn't take it down by pencil in front of the informant because it embarrassed them or worried them. So that you've got that memory slippage in there. But at any rate, he began teaching this course, and they sang. They sang ballads. I know I can remember now hearing them roar out the whole length of Richardson Hall, to the great annoyance of the education department, who believed in creative experimental teaching but were horrified when some was going on under their noses. But these young people went out to their families and their grandparents and their neighbors and began bringing in an amazing lot of material. Fabulous stuff. And out of that came Body Boots and Breeches. Mm-hmm. And over these years, Thompson and I were increasingly close friends. He and his wife were very, very good to my wife and me, my first wife. And there was an interim year when I worked for Syracuse, but then went on the English faculty. So that from 1934 on till 1946, I was at Albany and teaching a lot of things, as you young instructor does. But Albany was good in the sense that the head of the English department, a man named Harry Hastings, insisted on every instructor who had to do English composition and survey was allowed one course of his own. Well, this was great. I loved teaching there. But Thompson was all his time developing the concept of a book. We talked a lot about it, and he'd show me the more interesting things as they came in. And then about 1935, I was reading a collection of Vermont ballads that had just come out, edited by Mrs. Flanders, Helen Harkness Flanders. And Helen Flanders was not yet, but was to be, the wife of, well, she was the wife, but she wasn't, oh, hell. Her husband later became Senator Flanders, the guy that really nailed McCarthy to the wall when the time came. A very rich, very level-headed, very interesting industrialist, Yeah, I was an old socialist in those days, and I had no awareness there were millionaires like that. Until we went up to visit them once, and here was a gentleman who took me up into his own library, and he had a closet off the library about the size of this room, with shelves all through it, with running files of the damnedest collection of magazines. I mean, many of them very technical industrial magazines, but then magazines of French literature. And, he was an extremely interesting person. And, they say every Pole has his Jew, and all of a sudden I thought I had a millionaire. I started to say that Mrs. Flanders brought this book out of Vermont ballads that she'd collected, others had collected. And among them was a ballad called Ballad of Henry Green. Well, the next time you're in my little office over in the library, you will see on the wall a broadside about the Ballad of Henry Green, who married a little traveling actress from a temperance play on Sunday, and on Thursday night began feeding her arsenic, and he done her in. Mm-hmm. Oh, this is over in Berlin, New York, just to the east of Troy. Mm-hmm. And the women in the community who had taken in, one feels rather reluctantly, this little traveling waif who had married one of their own, suddenly began to realize something was wrong. And as they brought her food and discovered that he always put something in it and so on, they got more and more suspicious, and they began to close around her, to protect her. And it's extremely interesting because it was the women against one of the men in their own village. But it only takes two or three days of arsenic. He was not a very bright young man, and he started out by giving it to her in two large doses. But in the ballad, it mentions the fact that they took him to Troy Jail, and that Judge I can't remember the judge's name, but it names the judge. Oh, that's a funny damn thing. I wonder if this really was in Berlin, New York. So I looked up the judge first, and sure enough, there was such a judge. And then I began looking through local records, and there was such a murder. And here was a case where here was a song in the oral tradition, and here were court records. And I had a chance to go back to that old interest of mine of how much truth do the people sing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was lots of fun. I discovered in the state library confessions and pamphlets of the time and broadsides. Then I went out to Berlin and found all the houses that were involved, still standing. The little store that he had owned and set on fire a couple of times to get the insurance was there, and the inn where they had, where the bride and groom were living, and families. The granddaughter of the sheriff who arrested him gave me the copy of the confession and the account of the trial and the broadside that are at the library. I gave the broadside I kept because, as you'll see, there was a reason. I wrote this up and took it down to the state library where the man who was editing New York history for the State Historical Association had his office, and I left it there. And by gosh, they published it. And that was my first publication in folklore. As a matter of fact, it was my first major publication. This was 1936. And in this magazine of the State Historical Association, which I knew about a little, my aunt was a member, and the New York history had always been coming into the house. I don't think I'd ever looked at it. You see, my historical education stopped in my junior year in high school when I had a one semester of American history. That was my total preparation for this job. I had a little English history, but and perhaps one European history, but I'm a folk historian. That is, I've had no academic training.
Well, you were talking about that ballad.
Yeah, well, that article came out, the Ballad of Henry Green, and it didn't do me any harm. I got interested in the murder ballads, American murder ballads, and the sources for them. I never did much with it. I did go on with an interest in murders. Later on, I observed this really in the Green case, that a murder trial is a murder trial, and the testimony in a murder trial gives you a remarkable amount of forgotten folkways and customs.
Mm-hmm.
And it's pretty reliable stuff because, while some people do lie under oath, they're less likely to lie under oath, especially about the common experiences of life,
mm-hmm.
than they are in a letter or in a diary or in a memoir. I remember, for example, that when this poor little girl was lying there in the tavern or in the place where she was, and the women came in, they fed her crust coffee. I didn't know what the hell crust coffee was. Well, here was an example of folk foods, folk medicines, which certainly was an obscure kind of reference. And it dawned on me then that there were a lot of other things in that trial. The relationship to insurance companies, the problem of rats, I don't know, the custom of sleigh rides, celebrating of a marriage, and so on, honoring the bride and groom. And so I began to watch out for murder stories. I got interested in a ballad maker named Henry Backus. Well, the Socrates Bard. And the Socrates Bard was an eccentric who lived in Socrates, New York, in the, 40s, I guess, about the same period, and wrote broadsides, which he then went around and hawked. He had a funny old wagon and a dog and a scrawny horse, and he would go around the Ulster County, and he'd go in the village, and he'd sing the songs and sell the broadsides. Then he went to New York. And there were a lot of local history incidents in these songs. And he went to New York and began writing ballads about current events there. And one of them was a ballad, to my delight, called The Baby on the Half Shell. Well, this is about the murder of a dentist in New York, and a woman who was possibly his bride and possibly his murderer. At any rate, she purported to be pregnant with his child when he was killed. He was splattered all over the ceiling. But she pretended to be pregnant and wasn't, and hired a doctor to smuggle a baby into her room. And a small basket, and this was the baby in the half shell. But the doctor had told the sheriff, and they all came in, and she didn't get the money. But this was another ballad history situation with a great deal of variance to material. So I did a paper on Henry Backus. Oh, this is much later. This is about 1941 or 42, I guess, which I read at the Geneva meeting, I guess, of the State Historical Association. In the meantime, other things had happened. Harold Thompson had finished Body, Boots, and Breeches, which came along at the same in the same half decade, the same 3 or 4 years, as Carl Kramer's Listen for a Lonesome Drum and his Dark Trees to the Wind. Now those, and of course Kramer was a friend of Thompson and by this time a friend of mine. What Kramer was doing really was writing folk history. He would research the stuff, but he would tell it the way the folk told it. When Thompson's book came out, it showed that not only were people telling folk history, but that in the state of New York we had this tremendous body of belief, legend, song, place names, a whole panoply of interesting material. About that time, Harold got his divorce and went out to Cornell on their faculty, leaving me in Albany with the great privilege of teaching the folklore course, which he had been teaching. I'd been doing some in the summer, I think, or an extension even before that. When he left, it was a one-semester course, and I taught it each of 2 semesters, and in the summer, and an extension, so that I would teach it four times a year mm-hmm. with very different kinds of students. That is, there would be these damn bright kids at Albany, because Albany had the cream of the crop in those days. And the summer session would be usually the younger, more ambitious teachers. And in the winter, you would get the teachers who were trying to get their degree. Mm-hmm. Very often they were people who would had a 3-year normal school training, mm-hmm. older teachers. Well, out of Harold Thompson's courses at Albany and at Cornell comes the great Thompson archive, which we have in the library. At Cornell, he found a very different kind of student, very often an urban student, mm-hmm. whereas the Albany kids mostly were from rural areas. But Albany had another advantage, which I found, and this was perhaps more so in my time than his, that we had awfully bright kids from the newer stocks, the Irish and the Germans and the Italians and the Poles, a few Negroes, not many, a goodly number of Jewish kids. And he and I both set out to see what kind of traditions their families had brought. And this, too, was a new idea. And it was Thompson's idea, not mine, but I heartily agreed with it. And so that both those archives are strong in not only the old stock material, but in the folklore of the later pioneer families.
Mm-hmm. This would be about what period?
Well, Thompson left Albany in 40, and I began teaching the course that next fall and taught it until the spring of 46 when I left. Now Carl Sandburg cropped up back in my life. Mm. Well, there are a number of people that came into my ken in those days. Harold Thompson had been in at Harvard with John Lomax. Mm. And so through Harold, I met John Lomax. And very shortly after it, he came back to Albany with Leadbelly. And Leadbelly had been out of jail about a week or 10 days. And John had him up at Harvard to meet Dr. Kittredge, the great Kittredge. And I must say, when I think about Leadbelly and Kittredge, it's a beautiful thought.
It's amazing. That's a combination.
Lomax brought him to Albany to visit with Thompson, and I think he may have sung in Thompson's class, but there was a really great evening when John Lomax, who really was scared of Leadbelly. Leadbelly had only, he'd only killed 4 or 5 people, and there'd always been a good reason. Since they were black men in Texas, it didn't matter a great deal, so that he'd always gotten out. And Lomax had been recording, Lomax and his son, Alan, had been recording in prisons in Louisiana, or Texas. Texas or Louisiana? Okay, Judge O.K., Governor O.K. Allen, I can't remember which state it was.
I think Texas,
that's their state. At any rate, they had recorded a song of Leadbelly's, which was an appeal to Governor O.K. Allen to release him. And the Lomaxes had played this to the governor, and the governor had turned him loose. I remind you, who come in here with a 2-pound recorder, that in those days, you carried with you a recorder that weighed never less than 50 pounds and sometimes 75, and some of them had batteries, which invariably went bad, mm-hmm. and some of them you had to plug in, and you were invariably in a place where there wasn't any plug. I have lugged those damn things up mountainsides and then gotten there to find there wasn't any electricity. So that when we say that the Lomax is collected in a prison, it was a tour de force in itself, mm-hmm. to get that much done.
Could I just digress here for a minute? You said you had lugged these old tape recorders up mountains. Did you do some recording yourself?
Yes.
Might I ask of whom or?
Sure. In the later 30s, probably 37, 38, 39, I was recording in an isolated mountain area in eastern Rensselaer County. Rensselaer County is the county across the river from Albany, and it goes up to Troy.
Right, I know.
And I had a little farm over there from 39 on. So maybe it was 39, 40, 38, 41, somewhere in there. I located a German community that had been brought in the very early 19th century by the von Rensselaers. This was von Rensselaer Patroon, who were woodcutters, German woodcutters, and they had been very isolated, and they had hung on to their German traditions. I, by this time, was interested in the folklore of the supernatural. And it was a rich place to collect good ghost stories, a good deal of folk medicine. I had a extremely valuable informant friend who was the Lutheran minister, and he would make my entree to these houses very easy. And there was a lot of witchcraft, but I would say strongest in witchcraft and folk medicine, and especially veterinary medicine.
Mm.
I very too early made the mistake of reading a paper at the AAM, or the American Folklore Society. They called me and said, "We're short one. Could you do one? We're short a paper. Could you do it?" And I did it with all too little preparation. And I remember the scorn of the great Ruth Benedict, who was the great anthropologist, over this performance. And it's a wonder I didn't go into shock.
Why was she scornful?
Well, it just wasn't a good job, you know. It wasn't properly annotated. It wasn't scholarly. It would have been a perfectly good speech to a lady's sodality, but it was. I was getting interested in the supernatural for a very profound reason. Nobody else was into it. The field was wide open. I didn't have any competition. And it occurred to me you could get to be a great authority very quickly if nobody else was in the way. So that I... And I found it interesting. I found it amusing. Mm. And I began working on ghost lore. My students... You know, it's an interesting thing in folklore. Students find what teacher is interested in.
Mm-hmm.
Harold Thompson's students found more damn folk songs because Harold could play them and sing them. Well, I'm tone deaf, and though I had 6 years of piano, I still don't know A from D. And my students found much more ghost lore than his did, and mine found almost no songs.
Huh.
But it's the old thing. You find what you're looking for. Years later, it suddenly dawned on me that when I was up there in those isolated hills of Germans and was looking for the folklore of the supernatural, the ghost lore and all that stuff, I never looked at their walls. What did they have on the wall? Were there any carvings? What iconography was there? I didn't have any idea. Well,
you can talk about lead bellies.
Yeah, well, there was this great party at Thompson's house, and we all sat around, and about 10 o'clock, Leadbelly got up on the dining room table, and sat in a chair with a bottle of gin by his side, and he started singing and playing his 12-string guitar. And we sat there till 4 or 5 in the morning, and singing, quietly drinking. Absolutely marvelous. Now, one of the great nights of my life. And then, when there was just one more swig in the bottle, he sang Goodnight Irene. And he sang Goodnight Irene not the way that the fellas hooked it up later on, but in the original version. And the Library of Congress record is a good recording of that. And I remember taking him down to the place he was staying that night. A gentle, kindly man, but I imagine a very difficult man when he was angered. But I want to put into the record a defense of Alan Lomax. Alan understood Leadbelly. He treated him like a man. John Lomax treated him like a nigger. Mm-hmm. And I use the word carefully. To John, he was a bad nigger that he was responsible for. To Alan, he was a friend. And when, after Leadbelly died, and that revised version, popularized version of Goodnight Irene became a great bestseller, Alan Lomax was in a position to have walked off with all of that money, and he didn't. He saw to it that Leadbelly's widow got it, and it was an act of the highest kind of integrity, and the kind of model for what the collector and the original source, what their relation should be.
Mm-hmm.
And Alan and I haven't always agreed, and I've thought sometimes he did silly things. But as long as he lives, I will admire his respect for his informants as people.
Mm-hmm.
And God knows Alan has done some awfully silly things. He got tied up in the Marxist business, and then in the Freudian business, and then some later things. And none of this did I sympathize with. On the other hand, what the hell does that matter compared with the kind of integrity that he's shown? I knew all of those men, or most of them. Stith Thompson was editing an anthology of American folklore that never was published, but I was doing it was a regional anthology. I was doing the section on New York. The irony of it was that the man who was in charge of it for the publishers left that publisher. I can't remember the name of it. But that young man's name was Arthur Wang, who became my great friend, and when he formed Hill and Wang, he published the section of my book on the supernatural, on the ghosts, and that's Things That Go Bump in the Night. Things That Go Bump in the Night was really just one-third of the book I wrote the year of my Guggenheim. The other two-thirds, individual chapters have come out, or sections have come out in articles, one on Evil Eye, one on Italian witchcraft, and so on. I got to know Carl Sandburg very well because he stayed with us. And
this would have been when?
Well, this is after I bought my farm in 39, so it would probably be 41, 42. I had little babies running around. And he came to Albany frequently because of the research of the State Library in relation to his life, his book on Lincoln.
Mm.
And but we read the galley proofs of the People, Yes, together. And I was with him the day it was published, visiting him at his home in Harvard. And he was a great experience. He was. The only trouble was that I had young babies who woke up at 5 in the morning, and Carl would want to. They opened the State Library for him so he could work at night. We'd leave there at 1 or 2 in the morning, and then we'd get home, he'd want to drink and sing until about 4 or 5. My poor wife, who was aware of the children waking at 5 or 6, didn't get much sleep in those days. Dick Dorson, after Dick went, got through at Harvard. I don't know what year that would have been, but in the early 40s. He did a kind of tour of the United States folklorists and came out to my farm and stayed. A bright, brash young man. It's always a little odd for me to realize that for your generation, Dick Dorson is a kind of poobah, because I've never been able to take him that seriously. He's been a very valuable man in the field with some very unfortunate hang-ups. His compulsion to feel that he has to define folklore for the entire country and that he must take his lance in hand and with a company of young Sancho Panzas following him go spearing against any windmill that defines it differently has seemed to me a waste of talent. And one has always suspected in the whole business of Botkin that if Botkin hadn't been so successful in his anthologies, which by chance he called folklore, that Dick wouldn't have been as upset. But it's too bad because it has embittered a field of scholarship which should have enjoyed itself together.
Mm.
Herb Halpert and I went back to Columbia to finish my doctorate in 37, fall 37. And Herb was studying in the anthropology department and studying American folklore. And knew each other then, have always been good friends, though have seen very little of each other. I'm hoping to see him this summer up in St. John. There was a famous occasion, well, not famous, a memorable occasion, when Harold Thompson brought Kittredge to Albany to give the graduation exercise, the graduation speech. The old man really, you can see why people thought he was God. He appeared, we were meeting him for dinner the night before at the DeWitt Clinton Hotel. Light gray suit, whiskers to match, long white hair, really looking like the New England stereotype of God. And we had 3 or 4 martinis before dinner. And then we went down to dinner, and he thought it might be nice if Thompson would like to buy a bottle of wine. And then after dinner, he thought it would be nice if we had a couple more martinis. They were pretty good. Well, he did a lot better than Thompson and I put together. And the next day, he came to graduation, and he stood up there in front of those students and gave the dullest goddamn commencement speech you ever heard. He didn't even make any pretense at a commencement speech. He read a chapter from a book on Shakespeare that he was writing. Absolute. It was a disgrace. But the evening's talk was very memorable. Mm-hmm. And not belonging to the sanctified holy men who had sat at his feet and gone out to be little gurus, I was amused to